Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter.
Well, welcome everybody. This is Andrew Fetter, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. And everything is such a great day. Everything seems to start fresh. I guess we had a lovely new moon starting on the 10th, and a lot of things have been changing, of course. Hopefully it will be greater and grander. Of course it all is. It's all in one's perspective. And speaking of perspectives, I have I'm very honored to have a very special guest to today's show. Before I get onto that, next week's show on April 19th, I will have Jim Stein, who is author of a book called Paranormal Question, which will apply scientific perspectives on clairvoyance and other phenomena. I look forward to that. But today I have a very, very special guest I've been trying to get on my show, seems like a month or so. Due time does come. Everything has perfect timing, as they say. And he is the author of UFO Singularity, which is a very fascinating book. It speaks a lot of methods of where we are technology versus a lot of subjects. There's some things taboo. I look at this book as more an anthropological book, by the way, of humanity. He is, by the way, a writer, a researcher, a lecturer, and of course he has his own, he's a radio personality, he has his own show, and he has been examining in a variety of approaches and studies with the unexplained culture phenomena, and of course human history and prospects of our technological future. He's also author of the book Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule. I'm very honored to have him on my show. Micah Hanks, how are you? Hello? Are you still there? I think we have some technical difficulty here. Micah, can you hear me? I apologize, we're having some problems right now. We'll find out what's going on. Thank you. Hello? Hello? Okay, I apologize, everybody. We lost our guest. You know those glitches here? Sometimes that does happen. I apologize, but we're going to get him back on. Just to get into some of the issues.
Yes, sir. Got you back.
I apologize, Micah. I guess we had a little glitch there. Anyway, I have just already made my intro toward you, and I feel, again, honored to have you on my show, and welcome. First of all, for getting into your book and stuff, just a quick background for my listeners on if you explain a little bit of your history and how you got into this studies.
Certainly. And I'll say this first. There have been two things that have been prolific while I've been promoting the UFO singularity. Those two elements, anomalies, if you will, have been cancellations. I've never been promoting a book or an anthology or an event or anything and had more hosts have to cancel, reschedule, even the day of. And, not against anything, against the hosts, of course, because often we do end up rescheduling, but there have just been so many little hurdles that we've encountered. The other thing, which is fairly obvious to your listenership and yourself now, is the number of call drops, mysterious disconnections, and things like that that happen. And so we always like to joke and say that it's the men in black. I couldn't confirm nor deny that that's actually what's happening, but it's begun to occur frequently enough that I have begun to orchestrate something of a testable scenario. Eventually, I'll formulate a hypothesis and try and come up with an actual scientific and a reasonable explanation as to why I get dumped so quickly and so often when I do these kinds of programs. So, anyway, with that all said, I like to kid around about a lot of these things, but I'm often billed by people as a skeptic, and I think a better term for it would actually be, a logic-oriented rationalist and someone who is both open-minded but also inherently skeptical in my approach to studying the unexplained. To summarize it all, really, I think I would put it to you like this. I think that skepticism and more of it is needed so as to better discern the actual anomalies. And we also must accept that there are, without question, things about our universe and about our reality and about human experience, considering that all things are filtered through human perception at the end of the road, at least relative to the summation of human knowledge. There are certain things within this universe and within human perception, with a scope of what we believe and what we perceive as being reality, that we cannot explain and account for. And so for me, it has been an ongoing process of learning to rationalize, but learning also to, you know, not exclude certain possibilities. And so rational, open-minded skepticism with both acknowledgement to fundamental conceptions and I guess what you would call general theories applied to, consensus reality and the like, as well as acceptance of the anomalies inherent to our existence. That has really kind of become the crux of my research. I guess any good researcher of the unexplained would hope to do the same. And so that's what Micah Hanks does and who he is. I live in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains, and I have a website called The Graylian Report. And, these are all, I think, fitting fodder for adventure and strange things, so we'll have a lot to discuss today, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you very much. And you know, it's funny you said about the mishaps, or perhaps like you can call it, maybe we need to get some internet or radio singularity here. there's a new one for you down the line. I was looking through because I was making up my own notes as I was going through your book, and I usually, funny, because when my girlfriend was looking, watching how I analyze, I go through it like I was looking textbook, and I start deciphering things that are your point you're bringing out, which I'm going to get into. I know you have general, but when people hear about singularity, they're going, what the hell, you know, for the now, what do you mean? Because that is a new term you're trying to, your application, what in simple form, so they know the broad stroke of it. What is the singularity in for the average listener?
Well, singularity can mean a variety of things, but in the context in which we use it and apply it to ufology, I am referring to what futurists of today call technological singularity. And defined simply, technological singularity has to do with the creation of smarter-than-human intelligence. This would probably manifest in one of two ways, which would be, of course, artificial intelligence, intelligent machines, and things that we eventually will, as long as human technological applications and the growth of our technological base continues unhindered, of course, we will in all likelihood create artificial intelligence within maybe the next 50 to 100 years that is capable of exceeding levels of human intelligence, maybe even sooner than that. Then the other way would be utilizing such technology as opposed to creating artificial intelligence. We might use such technology to augment natural levels of human intelligence, or both of those could occur within, you know, our reality, living alongside one another, artificially enhanced or technologically enhanced humans living alongside artificial intelligences, so that we have a race of or a couple of different varieties of super beings that exist in the future. But when we talk about these sorts of things and the creation of intelligence that may exceed human intelligence, again, we have to look at what I think comfortably I'll refer to as the alien meme here, and more broadly, ufology, because UFOs we take to be some sort of a technology that exceeds what technologies are known to exist on Earth today. And while there's a difference between technology and intelligence, obviously for there to be a technology that exceeds known levels, you know, available to humans today, there would have to be an intelligence of some sort behind it. Would that intelligence likely be our own, or from here, or from in other capacities, from, you know, would it be human in origin, I guess? I think that there are a variety of ways that that could still be the underlying, answer to the UFO phenomenon. But one way of approaching the study of UFOs, and probably what, although I try to distance myself from what has become known as the extraterrestrial meme, it is probably also arguably the most popular interpretation of UFO phenomenon and the underlying riddle behind it. How is this advanced technology in our midst, if it couldn't be something of our own, as many would logically say is impossible, that such an advanced technology is anything of earthly design? If it is not that, what else could this be? And so it has become much easier for people to place their bets on the gambit that we are dealing with extraterrestrial life. I'm quick to point out to people that there is no proof of that. And while that is a possibility, we have to draw distinctions between proof and then the mere evidence that constitutes some proof that remains unanswered. With UFOs, we are certainly dealing with something that remains unanswered. We don't know what they are. But what we do know is that there is an intelligence behind it, and there appears to be a technology that exceeds what we know to exist today. And so the parallels between what we know to exist, where we expect to go with human technology, and what we already witness with UFO technology, to me, illustrates a very clear parallel between what futurists and scientists of today call eventual technological singularity, or another uncomfortable term for it, transhumanism, and, of course, what we here in the fringe like to call the study, the serious study of ufology. I think that there's a distinct parallel, and so with the UFO singularity, I may not have been the first ufologist to think about the parallels between transhumanism and the UFO or extraterrestrial meme, but I certainly have, I think, been the first to try and articulate clearly and concisely in a book-length manuscript what we're dealing with on terms of singularity and the technologies we may attain eventually.
Well, it's actually been seeded in a lot of movies. Like, I give you, what you're talking about, which reminds me of a lot of aspects. First of all, just doing the UFO aspects and our technology where it meets is the classic first contact in Star Trek, for those who are Star Trek fans.
Mm-hmm.
Where our technology, where we were able to go past the speed of light, where when we go past that Mach, when we start going faster, when we start seeing these achievements, is some people have the view that, you know, and you bring in your book, where we deal with certain technologies and military aspects, where there's questionable interactions of UFOs, like whether on a military base, a nuclear site. There's been some interactions. We have Foo Fighters in the past. There's so many things. But as we advance, but maybe, and this is always hypothesis, that we're already being watched, and then, you know, we're still pretty we're pretty much barbaric until we meet our technological advances toward others. But then we also have the issues, which is another one, is which is not, I didn't really see in your book, that we do have serious economical, I'd call political economic versus science and real science and real technology that has stifled from our advancement of human science. So you got two things going on at the same time, which also maybe has an interaction with the hypothesis of why I'm just saying ETs or extraterrestrials don't even want to interact because we're pretty not exactly the most civilized of probably in the universe. But one I want to ask you about, and you were brought this up in your book, which is pretty fascinating, is you start elating into – oh, there's another thing I want to bring up. You brought up another thing that was reminded me of another movie. I was telling my girlfriend on the way, you might be there, I can't remember the name of the movie, but they actually made robots, and the robots became almost like living our lives. They did our activities, and people were sitting around lying in their bed and making the robots do. In fact, they'd interact. It basically, they were sitting around. It almost felt like when I was reading your book, that's what I felt. What are people going to sit around and with little goggles on their heads or something, and they have these other technologies doing their work for them, and then what are we going to evolve into, blobs in that matter? Or I mean, I don't feel like that.
Well, you know, I mean, really quick to address a couple of things that you mentioned there, Andrew. First of all, I have often wondered, I mean, if you go to the grocery store, there used to always be a baggage boy or somebody who would stand there and who would help you bag your groceries, and someone who would be scanning the groceries and actually working the cash register for you. And although you'll always see that, because I think a lot of people prefer to have someone perform a service for them as opposed to do it yourself. I'm a do it yourself kind of guy, and you'll see me whizzing through the self checkout. This is a simple example in modern culture where we see machines replacing jobs that humans exclusively once had to do, because now we have computers that can do calculations and things. And of course, even when we had computers, we still had to have humans to operate those computers so as to populate, correctly ring up someone's groceries and calculate their bill and charge them, accept the money, and put it in a register. Nowadays, we have machines that can actually do these things for us. Another example I was reading about just today, and I linked to my daily news roundup that I feature at the Graylian Report, was a Wired magazine article talking about how there are now companies that are designing, I think one of them is, I can't remember the name of the the actual company, but it's linked there. And the what they're actually doing is designing computer programs that can use algorithms, get this, to write news articles. They can populate information from sources, from articles, from blogs, and can actually produce computer-generated news articles utilizing an algorithm that would mimic the journalistic style of a writer, of a human writer. So in the future, again, even journalists, people who go out and who report on the actions and the happenings of other people, it very well may be robots that are reporting on the actions of people in the future. So that's one thing. And then another point to mention is that you'd kind of talked about how in science fiction films, there are a lot of instances where essentially UFO or UFO-related subject matter is sometimes dealt with in relation to singularity. And you're absolutely right. And actually, I would take it back even further. Well, actually, Star Trek, you mentioned, actually predates this, but 2001 A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick's film, really all the elements of UFO singularity are right there. Humans traveling and populating distant regions of the universe. Of course, we don't leave our own galaxy in this film, but you know they nonetheless go to Jupiter with the implication of going beyond the infinite. They have a transdimensional kind of non-physical encounter with an alien being. And, of course, there are also artificial intelligences that work alongside humans in the film. So, really, all the elements are right there. And you're absolutely right that I think something – and what you bring up in pointing that out is very important as well, because while I think mainstream ufologists and, of course, the academic community are hesitant to draw parallels between what we call fringe or strange or unexplained phenomena and, of course, what are known to be scientific laws and then, of course, speculative theories about where humanity is going, like transhumanism and singularity, science fiction, it seems to remove the bounds as far as where speculation can go. And often I think there are more accurate, you know, portrayals of where we might end up that are afforded us in things like science fiction and fantasy, simply because it removes those kind of cultural conservative boundaries that science won't go beyond.
That's called the Jules Verne effect.
Yes. Yes, it is.
That's what the IMR professors once called it that. It's like, you know, who thought in the 1800s they're going to be sending a spaceship to the moon? But I want to get to the, you know, you brought up thing about our tech and our science and all that stuff, but there's one really underlying barrier, and that's what I see in our sciences, and I'm just being straight up, is like, for example, we actually today have the ability to produce free energy with the radiant energy and what, so we don't even need to work on, utilize fossil fuels for energy. Yet, out of political economics, where we don't employ the technology that we do have. Then you have also where today's medicine hasn't even caught up. Medical science hasn't even caught up to modern physics. I mean, it's like 30 years behind the line. It's now just starting to utilize electrical mag energy to fix people and stuff like that, because they usually utilize diagnosis of a method of using energy, but then you try to fix us like plutonium parts, like Newtonian. Systems like we're, you know, car parts, using pills and whatnot, and it hasn't even caught up. And I had a lot of, and this gets in the perspective of things, but it also has to do with a lot of the factors of political economics is actually stifling our technology, where that's actually holding us down. Or if you want to call it mainstream, and that's also subjects to what you're talking about, I think, with scientists, where there's a political question mark, you know, put on them as well. It's just like the same thing when people talk about, it's like, I don't want to go off of this tangent, but off of climate change, you know, and they're using models that are really not, there's no such thing as a carbon model for. That's back in the 70s for our weather change, and actually changes because our electromagnetic changes in our environment has nothing to do with carbon. So, like, you know, they don't want to admit to it because of politics, out of economic politics. And it's, you're right. If the first scientist starts talking about UFOs, they start going quacky, but they can talk about now. You know, maybe the shamanisms are right now. They're, you know, it's going baby steps. So where do you see where – my biggest question, I know this is leading away. When do you think a reputable science – because we've had reputable astronauts say, yes, we have UFOs. We do have ETs. There's been some kind of interaction, and we're going to go through that. Because there actually has been evidence, but there, nobody wants to admit the evidence is being proof.
Right.
That's
well, I would say that's a complex question, but I'm glad you bring all that up. Let me say a couple of things first. With regard to astronauts having UFO sightings, you're absolutely right. There have been many instances where things have been witnessed from space. The early Apollo missions often talked about a craft that they believed maybe had been a portion of a thruster or some other man-made object that nonetheless was visible in orbit or near them, or in some instances, craft that appeared to be actually following the NASA craft, whatever the case may have been, if it was Apollo or whatever else. I think Story Musgrave had also claimed he'd seen a UFO while he was in space on one occasion. That was much more recently. I think that probably took place back in the 1990s. And, even if you go back before space exploration, when some of our NASA astronauts weren't actually active in the space program itself, Gordon Cooper, for instance, had been filming some tests or overseeing the filming of some tests out on a dry lake bed somewhere in the American Southwest, if I remember correctly. He talked about this in his biography. And Gordon Cooper also claimed that a saucer-shaped craft appeared, landed, that it was filmed, observed, and then it took off, and that the film was handed over to his superiors and, of course, spirited away and never talked about. But he definitely talked about that in his biography. So, yes, there are some very, very, very interesting instances where even Apollo astronauts, or not just Apollo astronauts, we'll just say actually members of the ongoing space program from day one and even beforehand had discussed having what could only be called UFO encounters, and some more compelling instances like Cooper mentioned in his biography, or his autobiography, I suppose, actual encounters with flying saucers, exotic-looking craft, and not just lights in the sky that could have been anything from an indeterminable distance. Now, coming back around to what you were asking in relation to economic forces and things along these lines that influence the progression of technology, I do talk about this just a little in the book when I hint at the idea that there may be suppressed technologies that could account for certain UFO phenomena. This is a concept that I guess Richard Dolan first began to utilize, and it was articulated thusly, the idea that there may be what we would call a breakaway civilization that is utilized, anything maybe ranging from secret Nazi, Second World War time advanced physics projects and having, after the war, applied those to avionics and such things. There's that possibility. There's also the potential that, although I think it's far more remote, that certain actual extraterrestrial technologies may have been captured, back-engineered, and utilized for purposes of terrestrial craft and of course, used covertly. When I speak with a lot of skeptics, I express my interest in the potential that there are geopolitical and geoeconomic influences that might cause certain technologies to be suppressed. And speaking with one well-known skeptic who I respect and I call a colleague, his name's Robert Schaefer, speaking with him recently at the International UFO Congress earlier this year, Schaefer had said, "Do you really think that there are secret technologies that the government keeps hidden away?" And the next question that often follows is, do you have any informants? Well, I certainly don't have informants in government that could attest to the validity of that hypothesis, but I think the history has shown that, the Air Force and other agencies will, can, and do utilize secret technology for purposes of national defense, not just in the United States. This occurs in other countries just as well, and the most advanced technologies aren't going to be related and released to the public immediately because, of course, we don't want the enemy, so to speak, to find out about what we have at our disposal. We want to be able to keep our best technology secret, especially during wartime. And even, if we're not in an actual war, I would argue that, a period in U.S. history, such as the Cold War, would also, if not during actual wartime, perhaps even more so than during wartime, the Cold War would have been a period where certain advanced technologies would have been kept secretive. And so it's interesting when I speak to skeptics who are quick to debunk UFO claims, but they're just as skeptical of the idea that secret government technologies might be employed and underlying certain aspects of the UFO enigma. That's curious to me because I think in some instances it's a more plausible explanation, and it illustrates to me how, as you've kind of pointed out, Andrew, there could indeed be geoeconomical influences that are involved in all this.
Yeah, but that would be pretty naive of them, because you can look at right now, they just can't, that's now out in view, they're now putting out laser guide, not just guidance systems, actually laser weapons on Navy ships. I don't know if you heard about it.
I did, yes.
Yeah, and then using energy, it's, you don't need missiles anymore. It's ray gun. We're back now to ray guns. Now, getting back to science fiction, who would have thought? And then you read about the reports. This has been developed back since the 70s. They were working on and developing it.
Of course.
I lived in Las Vegas, and you can tell your friend, have fun trying to drive near Area 51. A couple of friends of mine who do some research over there, and they're one of the exposures of the Area 51, and they always question that. And that talks about the reverse technology, that whether, because a lot of skeptics I know who talk about UFOs is, well, that wasn't really a UFO. That was like, that was really where the triangle ship was really a high-end spaceship or a high-end development. So begs the wonder whether that becomes the question where I hear from skeptics is saying, hey, you know what? Maybe the UFO stuff is just thrown there as a gamut to divert people, to let them look at UFO stuff, you know, chasing the rabbit, while the old magic trick, we're really doing our real studies. But then,
that's a good point.
But then it changes on that, because, again, you know, there's been multiple instances. I'll bring one actually. Living in the Middle East, in fact, this is recently, they are showing an Israeli spacecraft flying, that the one that knocked out the nuke facility in Syria, had showing the a jet flying, and there's three UFOs flying behind it, and people really didn't even realize it. And there've been more and more worldwide sightings, and not just the crazy nuts kind of thing people would apply, but groups of people, more and more of sightings and more evidence. And it didn't seem like that was, and I personally think it's just arch, you know, it's a changing of our perception of things. Because it's like, I think you're probably aware of the, like when the first ships arrived to off the coast in the Americas, and maybe some Native Americans didn't know what never saw a ship before, so they never really saw it. So it's where our perception is, where we are, where we can accept in our own realities, and I think that has a lot to do with it. But I think that getting back to the economic thing is, I was getting to the point where there's, you on one end, you're talking about the secret subversion of technology, but I was talking about also the political dynamics, for example, economics dynamics, because if you get to realistic, we had free radiant energy, well, pretty much almost free, as what Tesla wanted to imply,
right?
That would so fastly hyper our technology, because it'd become a day-to-day, if people wouldn't need to worry about eating food, and things would be like what you're talking, very robot-like. Money would become non-existent, because we'd move away from a monetary system, since energy is our source of producing things generally. So it would change dynamics around the world, our societies at all. And that would actually accelerate all the things that you're talking about. And I personally feel that's the missing link to what you're talking about. The missing link for our humanity to change is really when we can get off the move to utilizing the energy technology that we do have. That would change our robots. That would change everything.
Let's talk about that for a moment. I've always been fascinated with Nikola Tesla, and he was kind of the ultimate optimist. He was also, it's funny to call a brilliant man, and I mean this as no slight to him, but, you know, I think that in terms of his ability to plan and think economically for his own good, he was a bit foolish, because although he was so gifted, you know, Tesla, and he honestly was so dedicated to providing and to giving to the people. Tesla didn't want his technology to be something that he solely would profit from. He wanted to, like you'd said, give essentially varieties of free energy. to people. And that came back to bite him because he died impoverished. And, of course, you know, some of his very best ideas were later employed by the likes of Thomas Edison, someone who throughout history has been touted as a genius. And, frankly, I think that although certainly he was smart and he was smart enough to profit from not only his own inventions but also from capitalizing on those of others, Thomas Edison, you know, he was nowhere near the innovator, nowhere near the innovator. And frankly, anyone who understands electrical theory, I even only have a cursory understanding, but I've studied the history of it quite a bit. Anyone who studies, you know, either electrical, you know, theory and electricity and magnetism, the interrelationship between the two, and knows the history of it, you know, you'd laugh at the mention of the name of Thomas Edison in that capacity when compared alongside the likes of Nikola Tesla. But he was so, you know, he was so honest-hearted, and his intentions were so good in terms of his desire to give to the world that he eventually lost everything because his technology, you know, if it wasn't capitalized upon by another, it was confiscated and kept hidden away by the government much later on. So Tesla, indeed, was kind of spearheading technologies that, for instance, if they'd been instituted properly and on a widespread scale, we would be living in a different future. We would be living on a different planet, I don't know about a different planet, but Earth as we know it would be different, you know what I'm saying? And so, but the thing is, and as you'd said, the reason that that kind of thing doesn't happen, I don't think it's because there haven't been any inventors that have come along that have matched the innovative capacities of the famous Serbian by the name of Nikola Tesla. I think it is much more the case that inherently, profit and self-interest tends to drive the market. And so there are innovative technologies, cures for cancer, and if not cures, treatments that are far more affordable and far more effective that exist today, that, again, because they're not profitable, big companies like Pfizer and our you know, lovely FDA, they aren't going to take any interest in regulating and, of course, profiting from the use of these kinds of drugs. So, yes, there are political and economic circumstances, clearly, that actually hinder aspects of our progress. And I think that especially when it comes down to there being technologies that allow free, easily obtained, and clean kinds of energy, why would you want something like that when more cumbersome modes of, for instance, you know, propelling ourselves down the highway, gasoline, for instance, and even ethanol, which is far less efficient than gasoline if you really look into, you know, how ethanol works. In the long run, it's less efficient and probably more expensive and certainly not very good for the environment when it's produced. All these sorts of things are things that can be profited from. Electric cars had been invented before, you know, gasoline-powered automobiles, and yet they weren't something that could be easily profited from. And so you're absolutely right. And in relation to talking about the UFO enigma, or, of course, as the crux of my book looks at, where human technology is going to go in relation to studying UFO phenomenon, I think that if there weren't so many hiccups that are imposed upon the growth rate of technology by, you know, geopolitical and geoeconomic forces, we certainly would be further along. And I also speculate further, and this is a point I make more clear in the book, although I try and stay away from conspiracies because that we can talk about all day, what we're discussing right here. But within the context of the UFO singularity, at one point I actually say I'm barring conspiratorial notions of suppressed technology from this discussion in this instance only because I choose, in, you know, for the sake of the conversation, to deal with the known quantities, the things that we know at our disposal that we can deal with. We would have to enter the realm of true speculation if we were to assume that there are indeed UFO-type technologies that have been suppressed. And think about this for just a moment. My buddy Stephen Bassett's doing a press release in Washington later this month to address some of the very issues we're discussing right here, based on the premise that our government is suppressing technology of extraterrestrial interaction with humankind and has actually stifled technological growth and kept hidden away back engineered flying saucer technologies and the like. I don't know that we have proof of that. And while that's a possibility, we can't prove that it happens. I think that there's a likelihood, though, if not extraterrestrial back-engineered technologies, there is certainly a likelihood that other technologies, perhaps exotic-looking technologies that have been created right here on Earth, have, will, and systematically are suppressed, and for, as you've mentioned, geopolitical reasons. And that has kept us here in the mainstream, the public as we know it, you know, the communities at large, even the scientists among us here in the civilian populace, we are probably at times largely unaware of certain technologies that do exist because they are they either aren't something that can be profited from directly, or they are something that someone seeks to profit from at the behest perhaps of others, and hence they're kept secret.
So basically, like, we're spoon-fed That's basically how I look at it. But anyway, I now want to go into another. I know I don't go. I don't want to keep on dwelling on this, but that's the obvious we got into. Another aspect I wanted to get into, which I thought really that's really brought in a lot of questions to mind. Where you talk about one technologies of the ancients, which you don't really get into, which I understood, but they're like the Pancho Pico, the pyramids. We have technologies they. Who knows what did that? There's a lot of questions like, was it aliens or was it some other species? I go Pancho Pico and they called a city that was built in one day by the Incas that they say they claim they didn't build, but we don't even have the technology even to build those big slabs that look like H's. They're razor cut. We can't even do that today. There's also the light bulb effect underneath I believe it was the pyramids or one of the buildings out in Egypt. You couldn't even light a torch in there. They had to have a device of electrical means to build, even down below, or make carvings. There's a plethora of questionable evidence of technologies in the past and who may have done that. So it begs to stifle this. The reason I was bringing this up because you had talked in your book about in time, and often people look in time, and I do this with clients, and I explain to them time and space, as we know, has changed in our perspective thanks to Einstein and other great also quantum scientists, is that it's basically multidimensional circle, which you then comes in the problem with when you're talking about time travel. And you bring in your book about maybe a lot of the things that we see are perhaps time travel, like from in this realm, like Back to the Future kind of thing. And they come back and we see like maybe humans from the future back into come here. And it was sort of quasi, I'm like, well, could that possibly have been humans? Or maybe they didn't want to interact because they don't want to affect the time, linear time of history with humans or past humans, which we are now, cause the what they call like the looper situation, or kill your mom. So how could that ever happen? As Einstein would say. So how, looking in your book, please explain what you're trying to elaborate on, that the issues of time travel and how our technology and the question of UFOs.
Well, I think one of the often touted explanations for ancient mysteries of the modern world, because they exist in the modern world, pyramids and ancient structures, city sites and things like that, and yet for them to have been built in ancient times, they would have, according to modern perspectives on these structures, they would have had to have employed advanced technologies, and hence their modern mysteries of the ancient variety, I suppose. So I think that it's often looked at as being something that's potentially extraterrestrial in nature, because, again, humans don't want to ever assume that, it's not that we don't want to, but it seems unlikely, and I would agree, that if we can't figure out how to build a structure like, the pyramid at Giza, or, for instance, the Stonehenge, or the large heads that are represented on the slopes of Easter Island, it's not that these things couldn't be built. I think in modern times, these things could quite easily be built. The problem is looking at how ancient humans would have done so in the absence of the kinds of technologies afforded us in the modern day. And I think that because of that, we have to begin to try and, we don't necessarily have to, but more often than not, we do begin to speculate that there is some sort of a technology other than that of terrestrial origin that was behind the structures, behind the building of pyramids and things like that. But what's curious to me is that, for instance, in modern America, with the exception of one large glass pyramid that's on the shores of the Mississippi River, if you visit Memphis, there are other instances where pyramids have been built in modern times, but that's one of the more popular examples in America. We don't typically build pyramids in America today. We don't typically build pyramids, in modern civilized societies anywhere in the world. And frankly, we don't have a lot of less civilized societies on the fringes or the outskirts of civilization existent today that are building pyramids. We don't have much to compare that by. And I think that the point I'm trying to make here is that if humans, let's say, traveled back in time, and humans from the future, of course, that were far more advanced than you or I today, they would have had to have been from a period, I guess, somewhere on down the road from now, because we don't, to my knowledge, have time travel at our disposal right now. So let's assume that humans from the future that were so equipped with time travel and other technologies, they travel back to ancient times. To build a pyramid, for a technology like that to travel back in time and build a pyramid all to Earth would amount to, you know, a child going out in the backyard and building a mud pie. It doesn't seem like it would be a standing testament to an advanced technology. More that, it would actually probably just lead to, you know, unsavory questions, which we're already faced with when examining the reality of the pyramids. And I think that rather than trying to dive into an incredible explanation for the pyramids, such as, well, you know, perhaps humans from the future did it, or that aliens from outer space came to Earth, visited, and decided to build mud pies out there in the middle of the desert, I think that, well, of course, parts of it weren't a desert at the time that the pyramids were built, but I think that a more logical way of looking at that is that, not to undermine human innovation, I think that at certain times throughout the lineage and the progression of evolution of humans throughout time, we have employed very specialized kinds of technology, things that we may not, again, have any use for today, but maybe a society that builds its belief systems and its spirituality around therianthropic gods, you know, that resemble birds and alligators and jackals and lions and things like this, you know, as the Egyptians did. They had, based on their belief systems, different cultures and different values, and they were known to be very advanced, and it seems likely to me that although the mystery remains as to exactly how it was done, very specialized technologies may have been employed in the building of the pyramids, and that humans in ancient times certainly could have actually done that. Philip Coppens and other researchers had put forth the notion that something along the lines of what we would call a geopolymer may have actually been utilized in the construction of the large blocks that actually form the pyramids. Now, to get away from that discussion, because the only reason I illustrate that is you mentioned pyramids, and I think it's important to address that in relation to the potentials for time travel, because thanks to popular programs like Ancient Aliens, we do have this modern notion, I think, that aliens visiting Earth in the past can really explain everything, and therefore we don't seek to try and understand, well, at least I guess, you know, in terms of a pseudoscientific approach to studying our ancient past, ancient alien theorists may not seek to try and understand natural human ingenuity. They, you know, instead they go to sites like Machu Picchu and Pumapunku, places along those lines, and they look at this and say, no man could possibly ever have built this in ancient times. Quite the contrary, I think that they could have. It's just that we're still trying to discover what kinds of specialized technologies were used. But by the same token, in modern times, we're talking about how, as you mentioned, Einstein has helped us to understand that time is not the immovable constant that we think it is. We've begun to look at space and time as being quite different from a Newtonian approach to understanding the physical world around us. And now when we look at the quantum elements that seem to make up the substrata of reality around us, we've begun to have to really kind of revise our notion of what reality is. And also to get this, to accept that there are aspects of reality that are inconsistent with one another as perceived by humans, based often on time and proximity and things like this. Time dilation shows that time passes differently between two objects relative to, of course, the influence of a gravitational force exerted on them, the speed that they are physically moving through what we call space and such things as that. Quantum particles often behave in ways that are inconsistent with, again, a Newtonian physics that we might have adhered to years and years and years and years ago before we had any notion that there were quantum particuli around, even though the concept of the atom, more as a philosophical concept than a scientific one, dates back, I believe, to ancient Greece, when it was first supposed that if you took matter of any kind and broke it down into a portion of matter that was so small that it could no longer be broken any longer, that smallest particle would be what we call an atom, atomos, I think is what they were called. And, of course, nowadays we also know that there are even smaller quantum particuli that constitute atoms. We have quarks, quasars, all these sorts of little things. And, of course, we're trying to find particles that may even be infinitely smaller than those. Who knows what we will eventually find. But all I say, or I say all this rather to point out one fundamental thing. As we begin to see that the nature and the fabric of space-time is woven together by anomalous behavior on part of these quantum particuli, if we want to call them that, We begin to also realize that perhaps if time and space are pliable, and we observe such things as spooky action at a distance, maybe these sorts of observable phenomena can be used to explain not only something along the lines of extrasensory perception, for instance, how a human mind could think and influence something that's occurring far away, perhaps even relative to another person's thought process and perception. I mean, again, relating that to spooky action at a distance, you know, we see where you can separate, you know, quantum entangled particles. And when we influence one, despite the distance between it and another, there's an instantaneous reaction that occurs elsewhere with the relative particle. I think that's fascinating. And, you know, most recently, I think that the discoveries of spooky action at a distance, which I believe Einstein actually coined that phrase, we seek to explain this and understand it better by taking this, observable phenomenon rather than technology, take it to the space station, take it into space and at the International Space Station, see if we can conduct tests in locations like that, where, again, the forces of gravity and other such, physical influences are either lessened or just different from what we observe here on Earth. If time can be studied in different ways just as well, what I actually speculate about and put forward in the UFO singularity is that perhaps rather than physical time travel, you know, a UFO or a machine of some sort that is designed to travel through space and time like Marty McFly and Doc Brown did in Back to the Future with a modified retrofitted DeLorean, it could also be that, as you have mentioned many times here during this discussion, Andrew, that perception has to change to understand UFOs. Well, I think perhaps human perception, if in the future it becomes augmented through the utilization of advanced technologies, that could allow humans to literally perceive space and time differently. And it doesn't remove the possibility, maybe even the likelihood, that technologies will be employed to also, or to perhaps assist in influencing space and time and allowing human perception of space and time to be changed in terms of allowing us to see future or perhaps the past, just as you or I might observe the present day right now. But I argue that there may not necessarily in every instance have to be a time machine designed for such purposes. I also argue that there are perhaps in the instances where a machine or some sort of a technology were employed for purposes of, playing with the spastic nature of time as we've begun to observe today, perhaps elements of that future technology would be observable by the modern human, and that certain UFO phenomena, certain unexplained phenomena, even beyond what we would call ufological in nature, but certain high strange or Fortean phenomena could also be explained by non-temporal phenomena emanating from what we would call our temporal future.
Well, a lot of people realize, like, if you look at time as like multidimensional, if you look at things in our universe as multi, I had a astrophysicist and he always use the word multidimensional because how they look at the universe is multidimensional, and again brings the aspect, and this is what I point out, like a lot of times where this, I don't want to get into shamanics or anything like that into it, but in reality everything is an infinite. When you talk about even us, we're actually 99.9% space. Mm-hmm. And then you look at all the stuff that even looking at, and since that's looked at on a matter side, and matter, since matter and time are actually one and the same, and so is space, since they're part of the same dimension, which is what you just brought up. Mm-hmm. Therefore, then time is unlimited in its own dimension. So therefore, that would change things. But for us, we tend to look things in a more looking like I don't know if you've ever seen the coin, the Chinese coin, there's the circle and the square inside, right? Well, actually, it has a lot of reasoning behind that. People don't realize it's because the universe and the world is round, and we tend to look things square. We tend to look at things in limitation. We look with our eyes, and we see, and that's proof. So I brought up to this astrophysicist, and I says, how come if the world as we know it, and this has always been shown from since the time of Einstein and even now quantum and now string physics and so on, that if the universe is infinite, why do we use methodologies of a finite process to order our understandings? And why, in fact, here's another thing that brings up, and this is where the crossing of both quantum and modern science and a lot of spiritual concepts or whatever, where if we're all nothing but energy, and energy, therefore, has a frequency, In fact, this is also a fact that, you know, how you see with your own eyes, right, you know, and your perception is limited by so many clicks per second. Well, actually, they know that if you raise your frequency was physically raised, that you would actually have a higher perception of the elements. So what you're talking is, I have to say, spot on, as they would say in Australia or the UK, that if your perception of things, your belief changes, you could actually see understand different dimensions of the time elements. And I think that is, of course, what's going on, where people actually start seeing UFOs or things, because maybe in the past we didn't have that perception. We physically didn't see it because we're energy, or we're like lesser, you know what I'm saying? And that's challenging our own religious belief system, which begs to my big, big thing, which you sort of tapped into, but didn't. It got a little bit in there. And I got into the scientific world, how they're so taboo of discussing it. But then there's and you brought in the alien versus the fear factor of humans of not being superior, which I think was right on. Because I think people, when they think of humanity at large, like, we conquered the world. We're the predators. We took care of technology with our predators, like any like sharks and stuff, or beasts. We can go out of guns and stuff. We can defend ourselves. But if you saw an alien who is so far technological or advanced, all of a sudden, we're not that far high. It would challenge us who we are, which also challenged the spiritual religious beliefs of some, especially Christian religions, and saying that, oh my God, it changed the phenomena. Wait, we're not the only souls on this world? What about them? What about their right. Jesus or Buddha or God or Allah? So it starts challenging our own perceptions, and people retract. And so that brings up the thing with you, with the challenge of technology versus challenge of spiritual and perceptual beliefs.
Right. You know, something I should point out, since you evoke terms such as gods and things like that in relation to studying humans versus aliens, and of course, you know, the limitations, perhaps, we would say, of technological development or general intelligence. Something I often have begun to point out, and it's funny because this concept didn't formulate entirely or completely in my mind during writing the UFO Singularity, but what's so beautiful about, I think, being able to be a writer, and in a sense, not to use the term in a hoity-toity way, but I think because it's an accurate description of my own intellectual and yes, spiritual growth, is taking on something of a mystical kind of approach to things. I don't think many people who would claim to be scientific in their thought processes, and again, I claim to be inherently skeptical, so they would shy away from a term like mystic. But, you know, what does the mystic do? The mystic isn't a person who claims he's going to go out there and he's going to study magic and he's going to, you know, manifest, you know, a demon or something. The mystic is the person who begins to question reality, who sets himself apart from deities, religion, and all these things, and goes after what, again, the ancient Greeks would, formulate in the concept of the monad, the one. We look for finding union with all things. This sounds like it's a spiritual concept, and yet, of course, what are we always trying to find in terms of scientific, a unified field theory or a theory of all things? We want unity. We want to be able to understand why strong, weak, electromagnetic, gravitational forces, all these different things appear as separate manifestations of what scientists believe emanating from the Big Bang or whatever the genesis of our universe may have actually been, what seemed to have been one constant, singular, unified, energetic force existing in our universe. We all are seeking unity, and so I do employ the term mystic in terms of one and their ongoing process of discovery, whereas Bruce Lee, the late martial artist, and he's less often referred to as a philosopher, but his philosophy should be read, he referred to as the process of becoming. I find myself being a mystic and a person in that ongoing process of becoming and seeking to find that unity. And so these ideas and concepts have begun to come together in my mind as a writer, and not during the writing process, but in the process of promoting a book through discussing, and very contemplatively at times, as we're doing here, the notions and the concepts that I put together in the book. The UFO Singularity is the beginning, and writing a book like that has helped me come to new determinations of different kinds of phenomena and perhaps, you know, different ways of perceiving the universe at large based on the beginnings of theories I put forward there. And one of those has been this, that when we look at
the idea that humans are some sort of a created being. You know, science seeks to understand how life began. Were there amino acids in primordial pools that, as the earth cooled, you know, in ancient, beyond ancient archaic times, and we're talking about, you know, beyond what we would even call prehistoric times, the genesis of Earth. We you know, it's this molten planet of you know, spewing fire and molten earth, and of course it begins to cool, and the cooling period that's occurring where we have warm waters conducive to the, you know, the congealing of amino acids and things that may have been not even life but the building blocks of life. What about these little processes that began to occur in nature led to the creation of, if not sentient beings, life, little creatures, little things? And then, of course, you know, those creatures begin to move and come together, and they begin to literally transform themselves into more complex shapes. They come together. Humans, in a lot of capacities, are no different from those little single-celled organisms that over time gradually began to either multiply within themselves or come together and form more complex organisms. And even though humans are complex multicellular organisms, perhaps arguably the most complex organisms known to exist on planet Earth, in many capacities, we exist nonetheless still as little separate entities that when we come together, we serve a larger, a greater purpose. And it seems that, you know, we kind of mirror our own formation throughout time as we go along. And there's this concept that we either were a chance happening, some sort of a you know, an initiation that was bred from and born out of chaos, which science seems to, you know, adhere to, or there is the idea that there is some sort of a genesis that was actually created by more than just a chaotic catalyst. Perhaps there was some sort of an intelligence behind it. Those of religious persuasion would call it a god, and I think that, again, for instance, an ancient alien theorist would say that there was an intelligence that came before us that may have seeded what we know as humankind, and then we're left with the question to ponder: if there was an intelligence before us, who created that intelligence? Does it go back to the inevitable creation of a god, or are we left to, you know, accept the troubling propensity of chaos being the father or mother, if you will, of all creation? And something I like to point out in that regard is this. Let's look at humans as one stage in the continuing development of a God creates Adam-like exchange that replicates ad infinitum throughout all, you know, parts of the universe for all time. Let's suppose for a moment, utilizing Judeo-Christian terminology, that a God created Earth, that a God created, more importantly, sentient beings like man and woman here on an Earth. We always look at a God in spiritual terms as being a entity that is far more, you know, omniscient and all-powerful than humans. God will always, because He is the Creator, forever be greater than what we are capable of. And that when we approach trying to mimic the powers of what we perceive as being a god or a creator, we are playing God, and therefore that is bad, and it is discouraged religiously. Now think about this for a minute.
Yeah, but you know what? I just want to say something to you about, because I know Hebrew, and I read the. It's funny. It says in the Bible, it literally says, Anu, that He will create. God will create a likeness like us, Anu, like us, like talking, like a whole bunch of people, like.
Yeah.
Like so maybe there was one little Tesla scientist whose job was to make a bunch of humans and played around the DNA, so he make people like us, and
yeah.
You know, that's a hypothesis. But I know we're coming down really quickly on time, and I want to really quickly go on the scope, because I forgot to get into this, which I thought was fascinating, the timeline sequence that you saw. Where we are now, and where you can you briefly? I know I want you to just. You're probably going to tail off our show, my show. Go through just briefly the timeline sequence you feel that where we're heading to, and this what you call the singularity, and in a hypothetical way. And also at the end, please disclose how they can make contact you, get hold of your book, or get in contact with you, as well as your website.
Thanks. Sure, yeah. I know we're running out of time, so I'll try and be brief. You know, it actually plays well into what we were just discussing. The idea that humans could create, just as a quote-unquote God might create us, eventually, if we do create artificial intelligence, the rough time frame that's been put forward, I don't actually lay claim to that. Ray Kurzweil and others, I say Jacques Vallée and Francois Meyer were talking about this as early as 1976. we're looking at probably within the next 20 years, the beginnings of what we would call pre-singularity technologies. Again, the creation of an intelligence that exceeds human levels of intelligence. And let's say for a moment it's artificial intelligence. If humans create an artificial intelligence that by design exceeds natural levels of human intelligence, if it's a self-replicating technology that can actually improve upon itself and rebuild and redesign and take evolution into its own hands, we're dealing with artificial intelligences, which may not be robotic. They may actually be able to utilize technologies so advanced that they can mimic biology. And we could be dealing with beings that are artificially created, but that are greater than us. So tell me this. How then is it that a god or a creator must be greater than and forever be greater than what it creates? In this instance, we see that if humans are creators, what we create may go on to be greater than us. And whoever created us in ancient times, we may have done just the same. That said, it's a pretty broad concept, and this is all, I think, what we're trying to talk about with the UFO singularity. We're looking at probably 20 years before we see the beginnings of technologies that could be applied to singularity. And people can learn more about the book, The UFO Singularity, at my website, GraylianReport.com. And you can find all the different ways to contact me there on the site.
Well, I want to thank you once again, Micah, for coming on my show. I know we try to condense to get a proper conversation. It probably takes about 3 hours with all the material that you have in this book. And I wish you well. This is an extraordinary book. I believe that this book can lead to other questions, which is basically what is point of life. Always question things, learn from them, and continue on the course of this journey. And thank you again, Micah, for coming on my show. Y'all check them out, and God bless you all, and have a glorious, glorious weekend, and thank you for listening. Thanks.